From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The dance troupe Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane and Company won a BESI Award for Best Choreography in 1986. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bill T. Jones, who continues the company after his partner Arnie Zane's death from AIDS. Ida Barrianjeri is a journalist who writes about multicultural issues. Her own family heritage represents different cultures. She's part African, East Indian, Native American, English, and French. Coming up, we talk about her new memoir featuring portraits of her family. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead remembers Nat King Cole both as singer and pianist. And we have a Valentine's Day greeting from Robert Kaplow and the Punsters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. The United States and the Soviet Union have agreed on a ceiling for the number of troops each can station in Europe. Announced in Ottawa by Canada's External Affairs Minister, the pact allows each superpower 195,000 troops in Central Europe and would let the U.S. base an additional 30,000 troops in other European locations. Other key elements of the agreement would cover limits on tanks and other conventional weapons in Europe. The agreement came during a 23-nation conference in Ottawa among NATO and Warsaw Pact foreign ministers. The East and West German governments will start to negotiate a common currency between the two countries next week. That announcement came during the visit to Bonn today by the East German leader Hans Modrow. Deirdre Berger reports.
Both governments hope for more results from today's talks. The West German government wanted to take more concrete action on an impending economic and monetary union with East Germany. But East German leader Hans Modrow, who was accompanied by 17 cabinet ministers, said the decision had to wait until a freely elected government takes office in East Germany next month. The East German government today asked for $9 billion in immediate financial aid from Bonn to shore up its struggling economy. But the West German government rejected the demand and said aid on that scale is only possible when East Germany has instituted a free market economy. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Cologne.
In what the Pentagon calls a prudent logistical maneuver, U.S. Navy ships have been stationed off the coast of Colombia just ahead of Thursday's drug summit in Cartagena. The Pentagon denied the deployment as part of security precautions for President Bush. In Washington state, thousands of teachers abandoned their classrooms today to protest the state's resistance to raising their pay. Carol Levinson has the story.
One of the major rallies was held in downtown Seattle, where an estimated 3,000 teachers carried signs decrying the state government's refusal to allocate some of its $611 million budget surplus to boost their pay. The educators, who say they work for peanuts, handed out packages of peanuts to passersby to illustrate that point. And Seattle Mayor Norm Rice told the crowd what it wanted to hear.
But I think it's time for people to understand that we want to see a return where teachers are the most honorable profession in this nation and in this state.
Washington teachers receive an average annual salary of $29,000. Many of them say if today's protest does not yield a satisfactory pay raise, a statewide strike may be their next course of action. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson in Seattle.
Prices were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 5 points to close at 2625.10, but declines led advances by about 120 in moderate trading of 144 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News. Freed black nationalist leader Nelson Mandela returned home to Soweto today. More than 100,000 people jammed a stadium to welcome Mandela, while thousands more crowded the entrances trying to get inside. Mandela expressed joy at being free after 27 years in prison and sadness that apartheid, what he called an inhuman system, still reigns in South Africa. Mandela again championed armed struggle to combat the violence of apartheid, but he called on the crowd to maintain the discipline of freedom fighters. Greek Prime Minister Xenophon Zolotos today announced a new cabinet to run the country until the general elections in April. The changes follow yesterday's withdrawal by the three main party leaders in a dispute over tax policies. Malcolm Brabant reports from Athens.
This is the second time in 4 months that these ministers have served in a temporary cabinet. All of them held office during the previous caretaker government after the collapse of the conservative communist coalition last October. Zolotar said that although his cabinet was only due to hold office until April, his ministers would force through new legislation on taxation and the environment. The leaders of the three main parties who yesterday withdrew their ministers from power have nevertheless promised to support Zolotar's interim administration. Zolotar became prime minister after November's election produced a stalemate. The coalition of conservatives, socialists and communists was designed to sort out Greece's economy. Despite their collapse, Zolotar denied today that his government had failed to perform. He said they'd managed to reduce government spending by $2 billion, twice as much as they'd originally planned. For National Public Radio, this is Malcolm Brabant in Athens.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir today said he would accept the surprise resignation of hardline trade minister Ariel Sharon, who angrily announced his departure yesterday to protest Shamir's policies in the occupied territories and on the Mideast peace process. Shamir struggled today to consolidate his leadership of his divided right-wing Likud party. Israel Radio said labor leaders are considering withdrawing from the government. Sharon Green in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane and Company remains the name of the dance troupe, though Arnie Zane died of AIDS. But his influence and absence are still strongly felt in the company's new dances. My guest, Bill T. Jones, began performing with Zane in the early 70s. By the mid-80s, they had become among the most successful dance companies in New York City. They performed at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, toured through Asia, and won a BESSIE, the New York Dance and Performance Award, for Best Choreography. Jones and Zane were known for their collaborations with visual artists such as painter Keith Haring, clothes designer Willie Smith, and artist Jenny Holzer. Since Zane's death, Bill T. Jones has continued to dance. He was seen on the PBS series Alive from Off-Center last summer, and he's currently collaborating with the World Saxophone Quartet on a piece which will premiere at the Brooklyn Academy of Music later this year. I asked Bill T. Jones about the inspiration behind one of his new dances, D-Man in the Waters.
It was inspired by a company member, Damien Acquavella, who was very ill with AIDS. And at the time that I was making the piece, in the late fall of 87 and in the January of 88, he was going through all sorts of procedures and regimes and trying many different things to, you know, regain his health. The idea of water was very strong in my mind. And then I had this image one day of people out swimming in the water in very rough waters, and some of them not making it, some of them making it. You know, ultimately it's about struggle in general. I'm very, very involved in the struggle with AIDS right now, but I don't want any of the work to get totally pigeonholed as being AIDS work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it is about struggle in general.
Would you describe, if you could, some of the choreography in that piece?
Well, let's see. If you can imagine, if you will, people throwing themselves into the floor with the same freedom and commitment that a person throws himself into a swimming pool, people supporting each other as if you were doing first aid, life-saving maneuvers with one another, people leaping and diving in such a way as to suggest dolphins and birds, a huge man, gigantic, kind of unpredictable presence on stage, standing like a monolithic totem with four lithe and women dancers with their legs draped around his neck as he stares into the heavens. And there's a moment where you want to laugh, but then you realize there's something quite arresting about it. Two other men rush on and dive, throw themselves in the air, and are caught instantaneously by two of those four women who were standing there. Constant shifting of patterns, people diving in from the wings, jumping off from the wings, music that moves as if it were a movie score for an old Western, but beautifully made. I say that if Mendelssohn was alive now, and he wrote this when he was 16, he'd probably be working with electric guitars and bass. It's a very moving work.
And the people make very convincing waves, too, kind of ebbing
so.
And flowing. I think that works really well.
Well, you know, that's a very kind of dangerous image because, you know, there's been a lot of corny work done about water, and there's been some great work done about water. This is coming from a place which is extremely athletic, and as a result, I think it has vitality.
It's been, I think, less than a year since your late partner Arnie Zane died.
No, it's actually more now.
It's more than
a
year?
He died in March of 1988.
Oh.
Right. So it's now, we're now approaching 2 years.
Oh. So much of your work has been involved with him over the years that I'd like to ask you a few questions about your long-term collaboration with him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I understand that he was 25 when he started to dance, and that was at your suggestion?
Yeah, 24 or 25. Yeah, it's true. He was just by nature a very creative and artistic person. And when I met him, he was just returning back from living in Amsterdam, and he was just beginning to do photography. And, of course, I was one of his prime models. We were living in Brockport, New York, and I was trying to get my degree in dance at the State University College there. And I invited him to come out and try this thing called contact improvisation. A little leaflet had been given to me that says, if you like to do the Lindy, if you like to do karate or jiu-jitsu or anything like that, come on out and join us. And I said to him, come try it. And, well, he was open to it. He went. Before that, he had moaned every morning when I would try to get him to do yoga, you know, just lay on the floor and put his feet over his head and touch the floor. He hated it. He thought I was a cruel taskmaster. But I said, you know, all the things of the, you know, the health culture, it would extend his life and so on and so forth. And in most things, we fought it out, but we found some sort of compromise.
Well, you did a lot of duets together. You choreographed a lot.
A lot, yes.
For him, since he lacked the kind of technical virtuosity that a dancer who got a start a lot younger would have, mm-hmm. how did you use that in the choreography?
Well, you have to realize that we were products of a time that was questioning all sorts of rules about dance making. If you know anything about the Judson Church movement, of which people like David Gordon and Patricia Brown and Yvonne Rainer were leaders, one of their whole ideas was to rethink the need for technical display, what was wrong with the pedestrian movement and the pedestrian limits, if you will, that these movements would bring to choreography. So we were very much influenced by those ideas, and contact gave us the freedom to understand that there were ways of really moving freely and eloquently that didn't demand pointed feet and turned out hip sockets. So we didn't feel at all fettered by that. There were whole other areas that had to be explored. We looked to the East. We looked to Tai Chi. We looked to karate, jiu-jitsu, for ways of doing a virtuosic but naturalistic virtuosity.
So many people have commented over the years on how you were opposites when you danced. You're tall, he was short. You're black, he was white. Did you use that in the choreography?
Well, I think it was... Yeah, I was going to say it used us, but I'm not sure that's too glib. We didn't know. I mean, not that we weren't total innocents, but like I say in our book, Body Against Body, the new one that's just come out now, there is something. We woke up one morning in Germany, and we were going to be doing our Blauwelt Mountain piece there. We had never thought that this piece, which took a cinder block wall apart upstage and built it through the center of the stage, we hadn't thought at all about East and West Germany, but suddenly we were in Berlin, and that context threw the work into a whole different light, and we were very excited by that, and the Germans were also very excited. They gave us a German Critics Award. Likewise with our physicality, we were friends before we were collaborators. We enjoyed each other's bodies before we were dance partners. So were we self-conscious about it? I think we later began to know there was power in it, but in the beginning we didn't, and that's mm-hmm. when it was most exciting, actually.
How long after Arnie Zane was diagnosed with AIDS was he able to dance, and did he want to dance?
Well, you have to realize that early on, Arnie used to joke. He said, those people who say to live is to dance, they're crazy. He did not feel that way about dancing. He danced. It had an interest for him at a certain point, and he considered himself always a person who would be creative no matter what he did. So he was becoming more interested in being a director anyways. So I'd say, our last major duet was probably 1983. We did duet was part of our work that we did in Intuitive Momentum with Max Roach at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in about 1980, late 83, early 84. The last time he was on stage, of course, I remember exactly, was in Cleveland in January 10th of 1988, which is pretty amazing considering he died March 30th of 1988.
Did you throw yourself back into dance after his death?
And throw is a very good word, too. Yes, I threw myself right back into the studio. I was very fortunate that we had already agreed to do these City Center performances on May 6th. He died on March 30th, as I said. Our rehearsals were scheduled to start again on April 4th, and we had plenty of time to feel the sadness, but we also had a job to do, and it seemed that it was the right thing to do. So yes, and I made immediately two or three new works and helped get a bunch of his works to stage, and I've been moving that way ever since then.
Now, you were an athlete before you were a dancer.
Yes, I was. I was a runner, and I was a sprinter, as a matter of fact. I was pretty good. My best time was about a 9.9 for the 100. And these days, I think high school guys do probably 9.5, 9.6. But for that time, it was pretty good.
How did you get from athlete to dancer, or from running to dancing?
I still feel
like an athlete.
I still feel like an athlete, and I'm sure my dancers would say the way in which I train them and rehearse them, I behave like a coach. That's for sure. I love sweat. When I was in the State University in 1970, there was this sort of holy lineage I'd been handed personally from my high school coach to the college coach, and they, you know, there was this real warmth I felt from my coaches, and I would do anything for them except. When I got to college, I began to become, well, things were changing. I mean, there was always the protest of the period. There was the drug culture. There was this thing called dance that reared its head that pulled me away from track practice. And I had a really understanding coach in college who said, okay, well, if you're in West African dance classes and you are working on your stretch and your cardiovascular, so it's good. You don't have to come to practice. Well, little did he know that I was being more and more seduced away from athletics and the macho locker room scene by that very daily practice of going to dance classes. There was also Arnie. He and I, the things that were that my discovery of my sexuality and all this stuff made it more and more difficult for me to be a part of the good old boy system of the gymnasium and the locker rooms. And so a lot of things were happening. And dance won out because, as I often say, there was something so incredibly right about a young athlete becoming a dancer. The abstract beauty of dance appealed to me, appealed to my body and that poetic side of my nature.
What did you find alienating about the macho locker room culture?
Well, it was not emotionally articulate enough. It was that I needed more passion, more closeness. I needed a way of understanding the myriad of things that I was experiencing internally and externally in a way that sports could not deliver, and that system of man at a distance, man fighting man, just couldn't deliver.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, I've now tried to go back and understand what it means to be a man and what it means to love that aspect of men, but keeping the sensitivity and the things I have learned elsewhere, and dance has been one of those places. Dance is a world which is peculiar because it's really dominated in a way by women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important. It was very important for me to understand that the strength and the softness of women and the articulation and emotionally that women can have.
Did you come out when you started to dance? Publicly?
Come out. Yeah, I guess you might say. I guess in a way it was. It was Arnie and I were friends, and I was on the track team. But shortly after we became lovers, I stopped doing sports and left school altogether. So dance was part of leaving school. I went to Amsterdam to try to be a dancer. Of course, I didn't know anything about it, and I was only 19. So it was all happening at the same time.
Was there anything about being an athlete that worked against you as a dancer, just in terms of like which muscles were developed and that stuff?
Yeah. First of all, athletes don't take much time to warm up. You just want to get out there and do it. So in the early days, I had to learn how to be kinder to my body, to take the time to breathe through muscles. And I think more sophisticated athletes, they know that now. But at that time, I don't think at the high school, college level, we knew that. Yeah, and maybe the attitude, too, of winning, you know, the purpose of this is to win. And also something about athletics, learning how to really be a team player. I mean, There's talk about being a team player in athletics, but it wasn't this type of sports that I played. I was a runner, which is me against a field of other people. So when I came into dance, I had to learn in a way how to make room for other people, read their signals, and understand how to read my own better.
My guest is dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We were talking about athletics versus dance, and you said you really love sweat. Is that unusual for dancers?
Oh, I don't know if they would express it in that way. As you know, in ballet, the conceit is that one should exert oneself, but it never appears that it's exertion. And I think in modern dance, ever since the time, I think, of early Martha Graham, even earlier, there was a kind of premium placed on stress and force and the show of weight. So our generation, I think, we've embraced the athletic quality of dance, and we share that with our audience, breathing and sweating. Yes, it's not unusual anymore.
You grew up in Steuben, New York, which is upstate New York?
Steuben County, yes. You've done a lot of research on this.
And from what I know, you were about the only black family in that area?
Well, not the only black family. The reason we were there, we were migrant workers. So if you can imagine a German, Italian, fruit-growing, potato-growing community, the blacks who were there were brought there to harvest fruits and vegetables. So there were, I would say, and I'm only guessing, in maybe a community of maybe 20,000 people or so, probably a few hundred were black, if less than that maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I was always the only black in K through 12 in my school.
Oh, really?
In my class. There were other blacks in the school, but K through 12, I was always the only black in my class.
So were you the official representative of your race to most people? You know, was there that burden?
Well, I guess in a way it was. I was very confused. That was one of the things I set out to rediscover in my years as an adult. What is my blackness? What is my racial identity? Because my mother and father, when they made the decision, my father, that is, that he wanted to be a black Yankee in about 1955 and to offer his kids everything that the white man had up north, in some ways he denied us the identity that one gets from living in a black community, going to black events, seeing black people and the black church and so on. So I didn't quite know. I knew I was black, because my mother was quite militant about it, but I didn't know how it connected politically to the world. And that's taken some years of participation to understand that.
So you probably grew up feeling not quite part of either black or white culture.
Yes, very, very confused. You realize that when we stopped migrating and settled in this area, I made friends. I bonded with the white kids, and to this day I'm still friends with a few of them. But every year there would continue to be this wave, this influx of migrants that would come from the South. So suddenly for about maybe a month, 2 months every fall, there'd be numerous black people there everywhere, little black kids, and poor ones too. So I had to find a way to talk to them and to talk to my friends who were, of course, steeped in a lot of racist points of view. And I had to sort of steer my way around that, be true to myself, and at the same time have friendships with these people that I live with year-round. It was difficult, but I think that's one reason I'm able to negotiate the art world today, because of that early training, finding one's identity even when you're the scenery around you shifts from moment to moment.
You know, I saw part of the contract that your company sends out to places where you'll be performing, and it's the only dance contract I've seen, to tell you the truth, so I don't know if this is typical or not, and I thought I'd ask you. It specifies that the heat in the stage area has to be 68 degrees at the coldest and 71 to 75 degrees at the warmest with no drafts on the stage area, that there needs to be restrooms backstage that the public won't have access to.
Yes, of course.
Is it important to...
And even then, you don't always get those things.
Really? I mean, you have to, like, insist on these kinds of things. Many places that you travel to wouldn't have restrooms for you backstage or a comfortably temperate stage area.
You'd be surprised. We have been in dressing rooms wherein... You know, you're dressing, and suddenly, you know, through your dressing room walks the people who are going to be seeing you perform at any moment, and they want to stop and chat, or they want to ask you, you know, where the paper towels are, what have you. Things get stolen. In terms of heat, you know, the workers will have the back door open, and the wind will be blowing through. You're in a complete sweat from running through something. You get chilled. People get sick, cough. You know, these things they do happen. It's not that we're just prima donnas, but people don't really understand what it is to work with your body as your primary instrument, and also the space that a performer must be into psychically and personally before they can give their best performance. Therefore, this privacy is necessary.
You're in the middle of developing a piece now with the World Saxophone Quartet.
Yes.
And the piece
is called The Last Supper at Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm. Anything you could tell us about the piece?
Well, the piece is really an attempt to... come to grips with a host of issues facing our nation, and the piece is from a pretty personal point of view as a man, a black man, a gay man, what have you, and I think I've been very, very moved lately in working with Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. We've been manipulating it in different ways, backwards and so on, but that speech to me is the quintessential expression of liberal philosophy. And the philosophy of liberation. And I asked myself the question, if it worked in the 60s and it could move a nation, how flexible, how expansive are these great words of his? Can it encompass all sorts of disenfranchised groups, be they gay, be they women, be they what have you? And part of that has to do with the question of faith, God, what does faith mean to me, my generation, those of us who have experimented we've had so many social experiments, and now we're sort of left facing mortality and death. What do we believe? The piece expresses all those things. Also, jazz music and new dance. What do we have in common? What can we find in each other? All of these questions are being asked.
Mm-hmm. One last question. Mm-hmm. Did you always have the T in the middle of your name?
As far as I know, it stands for Tass. This is one story I heard. And Bill Tass, I was told, was a racist governor of Georgia, and there was a song called Bill Tass Will Kick a Nigger's Ass. And my father had a great sense of humor, so when I was born, he named me Bill Tass. That's a story I've heard.
Huh.
So, yes, Bill Tass Jones.
Okay. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dancer and choreographer Bill T. Jones. His collaboration with the World Saxophone Quartet will be presented at the Brooklyn Academy of Music later this year. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air. The phrase, 1,000 points of light, may have won George Bush points during his presidential debate, but he didn't think up the phrase. It was written by speechwriter Peggy Noonan. She'll be with us next time. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ida Barry and Jerry is an African-American journalist who writes, "Nobody really knows us. So institutionalized is the ignorance of our history, our culture, our everyday existence, that often we don't know ourselves." Coming up, we talk with Njeri about her new book of family portraits, Every Goodbye Ain't Gone. Also, it's been 25 years since the death of pianist and singer Nat King Cole. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has an appreciation. And we have a Valentine's Day serenade from Robert Kaplow and the Punsters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The U.S. and the Soviet Union have now reached agreement on a ceiling for troops that they can station in Europe. According to officials in Canada, the U.S. and the Soviet Union each can have 195,000 soldiers on Europe's Central Front. For the U.S., that's basically in West Germany. In addition, 30,000 U.S. troops can be based elsewhere in Europe. The U.S. now has about 305,000 troops in Europe. The Soviet Union has about 565,000 in East Germany, Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia. In other news from Ottawa, the four wartime allies agreed today to hold summit meetings to talk about German reunification. The U.S., Great Britain, France, and the Soviet Union will be joined by the two Germanies for the talks. Richard Reynolds reports.
The agreement was reached during behind-the-scenes talks at a joint NATO and Warsaw Pact meeting of foreign ministers. The communique issued by the six foreign ministers was similar to the proposal being pushed by Secretary of State James Baker. The so-called 2+4 plan would see the two Germanies deal with political and economic details of unification, while the four powers dealt with security concerns. The summit will likely deal with the question of whether a united Germany was a member of NATO or neutral. No date was set for the meeting, but preparations will begin soon. The summit will likely be held sometime in summer or fall, so that the four powers can report to a special gathering of all European leaders to be held in November. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds in Ottawa.
In South Africa, Nelson Mandela is spending the night in his own home for the first time in 27 years. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Mandela was released from prison on Sunday, but today he came home. First, he addressed an overflow crowd of more than 100,000 people at a soccer stadium near his Soweto home. Afterwards, he and his wife, Winnie, went to the house where he lived before he went underground when he helped establish the military arm of the African National Congress in the early 60s. Talking to the crowds at the stadium and in front of his house, Mandela said that education was the main weapon in the struggle for political rights. He said he looks forward to the day when the young people can assume responsible positions in the new South Africa they are trying to build. Until then, Mandela urged them to make his welcome home very special by going back to school tomorrow. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Johannesburg.
The Wall Street firm of Drexel Burnham Lambert announced today that it will file for protection from creditors under Chapter 11 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 5 points to close at 2,624.10. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. This Thursday marks the 25th anniversary of the death of Nat King Cole. Cole began his career in the 30s as a jazz pianist, then went on to become one of our country's great popular singers. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has an appreciation of Cole.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you for that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile?
That's the Nat King Cole that everyone remembers. But this is also the sound of Nat King Cole.
Thank you.
he became a singer, Nat Cole was a superior jazz pianist whose style bore the mark of his early hero, Earl Hines. In 1937, Cole founded the first of his jazz trios. The format was always piano, guitar, and bass. The original trio featured deft interplay between Cole and guitarist Oscar Moore. Nat Cole's trio sound was very influential. The virtuoso pianist Art Tatum formed a band with an identical lineup in 1943. Legend has it that Cole began singing a few years after he put the trio together to pacify a bunch of drunks in a bar. In fact, he sang on his first recording date as a leader in 1938. It was recently released for the first time on a Savoy jazz album called Nat King Cole and the King Cole Trio.
First shouting, howdy-ho, then you start in morning low. Feeling low, then up you go, got the jitter-jumper-jitter you love. Love should be a symphony, but it swing too hot to be. Just a goofy rhapsody, got the jitter-jumper-jitter you love. You got
Cole's vocals became increasingly emphasized in the 1940s, eclipsing his work as a pianist. Some jazz fans never forgave him for that. But look at it this way. There are more great jazz piano players than there are great male jazz singers. Cole didn't just have an irresistible light tenor voice, which got rounder and more full with age. He also had an incomparably relaxed and swinging delivery. Here's one of his hits from 1943.
It is only April moon hanging over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believe in me. It is only a canvas sky sailing over a muslin tree, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believe in me. Without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love, it's a melody played on a penny arcade. It's a Barnum and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believe in me.
When Nat Cole accompanied his vocals, his piano style became different, less flashy, more streamlined and modern. He sounded more at ease than before. If his piano taught his voice how to swing, his voice taught his piano how to sing. Happily, he continued to showcase his piano playing as well as his vocals, sometimes anyway. One place his voice and piano mesh is on a recently reissued 1956 session for Capitol, called After Midnight. For that album, his trio was joined by jazz soloists like alto saxophonist Willie Smith.
Just you, just me, let's find a cozy spot to cuddle and woo. Just us, just we, I've missed an awful lot, my trouble is you. Oh, gee, what are your charms for? What are my arms for? Use your imagination, just see you, just me. I'll tie a lover's knot around wonderful you.
Nat Cole was one of the most successful American singers of the 1950s. He appeared on numerous TV shows and finally got his own variety program in 1956. On that show, he managed to sneak in some jazz piano along with the easy listening.
We will raise a family, a boy for you and a girl for me. Can't you see how happy we will be?
Will you play a piano solo, piano solo, piano solo?
Thank you.
Nat Cole conveyed more of the elegance and invention of jazz to the general public than any other pop entertainer, Frank Sinatra included. When Cole sang, his listeners absorbed the sound of jazz whether they knew it or not. That's his legacy to everyone who listens to American music. And that's why this hardcore jazz fan doesn't regret Cole's decision to become a pop star.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence.
That lucky day when I marry sweet Lorraine.
This is Fresh Air. Ida Barrianjeri writes for the Los Angeles Times about multicultural issues, immigration, assimilation, and ethnic diversity. Her own heritage is multicultural, African, East Indian, Native American, English, and French. Her new memoir, Every Goodbye Ain't Gone, is a series of sketches about her family and herself. Meg Wolitzer reviewed the book for the New York Times and described it as an impassioned attempt to explore and expose the complexities of an overlooked heritage. The first portrait in the book is about Njeri's grandfather. He was from Guyana and had settled in a small town in Georgia to practice medicine. In 1960, he was killed in a car crash. 23 years after the incident, Njeri decided to return to her grandfather's town to find out what really happened the night of the crash. I asked her how much she knew about her grandfather's death when she arrived in Georgia.
We had only heard the rumors that drunken white youths drag racing through this small southern town had collided with his car, and that one of the drivers of the car was the son, it was alleged, of the sheriff, and that there was a cover-up. Most people believed that the actual accident was that an accident, but that the cover-up was racially motivated. But there were suspicions in some quarters, because it went all over the news in the South, because my grandfather was a prominent civil rights activist who had come to the United States from Georgetown, Guyana, around 1917. And because he was politically active and known to be a supporter of the NAACP, which was considered radical in those days, people believed that it was a racially motivated killing. It was a Klan town, and people knew it was a Klan town. And so I went back 23 years after the fact to find out the circumstances of his death, why he had been killed, was it really an accident, and if there had been a cover-up.
And what did you find?
When I found that, I found a lot of people still afraid. Even my step-grandmother was afraid for me to go back, which was one of the reasons for me to go back, that she could still, almost 25 years later, say, they might desecrate your granddaddy's grave if you go back. That was all the motivation I needed, that she still had such deep, deep fears. I remember the night that he died, hearing stories that she ran out of the house in her nightclothes, her white nightgown flying in the darkness and her long fair hair flying in the night. And as she approached the crowd that had formed around my grandfather's wrecked car and his broken body, she pushed through the crowd and asked the police, what happened, what happened, what happened? They said, oh, don't worry, ma'am. It was just a nigger. Well, they thought she was white. And when I went to that town, I found that one of the members of the jury said, well, you know, we knew him, and he was a nigger. Wasn't much communication between whites and niggers back then, but he was an uppity nigger, and just as well he died that way, because if he hadn't, someone would have shot him. And when I found out that my step-grandmother had filed a civil suit asking for $100,000 in damages and had won, which was surprising that an all-white jury had even given her the small amount of money she did get, which was $6,000, not the $100,000, I asked this juror, well, why such a small sum? And he said, well, you know, that was a lot of money in 1961, $6,000, and after all, he was a nigger, never met a $100,000 nigger.
Well, you actually knocked on the door of the person who was in the car.
Right. I had found out that his father...
The person who was
who
in the car that killed him.
Yeah, who was the driver, who had been, I found, named in the local newspaper as the person who was responsible for the accident. And the police report said he was drunk, but he had never been fined in any way. Nothing had happened. And I found out his father was still in Bainbridge, and from his father I found out the man was in Albany, Georgia. I talked to him on the phone. He refused to really, you know, see me. And I tracked him down to Albany with a photographer and went to his door to try to talk to him. To make a long story short, he basically, you know, didn't want to talk to me. And when I went back to Miami, where I then worked for the Herald, to write the story, a woman who lived in the town knew I was working on the story through a friend, I guess, and she came and said she wanted to talk to me. And she said, you know, my family had lived in Bainbridge, too, back in the 30s, when my grandfather had lived there. And she said her uncle had been beaten to death in the woods by a bunch of rednecks. That's how she described them. And the death of her uncle, you know, almost destroyed her entire family. It drove her sister almost insane, her mother almost mad. And she told me, her name was Marjorie Klein, that they had beat him because he was a Jew.
So what feelings were you left with toward the man who drove the car that killed your grandfather?
Well, you know, I depersonalized my feelings to a certain extent because he ceased to be so much an individual as representative of a mindset of people who probably in their minds didn't think they were racist but knew somehow that even if it were only an accident, it was just a black man and that they could heave a sigh of relief and know that it ultimately wouldn't matter. And going back, I recognized that there had been many grandfathers like mine, many uncles like Marjorie Klein's, and that in knocking at this man's door, I was going to bring the past back and to let him know that someone had indeed remembered.
So you thought you did the right thing by reminding him and by being there?
Yeah, I did the right thing.
You write about your father in the new book, and he was a Marxist, he was an intellectual. Someone who would never, though, be accepted into the intellectual establishment because he was black. He also had a negative side, and that is that he was an abuser. He beat your mother. He beat you once. And you really went through your childhood being afraid of him and not liking for him. You went through a period where you'd sleep with a knife under your pillow. Did you ever need it?
I probably did need it, but I was too scared to use it. It was pathetic, you know, a small child. I remember I had found this knife on the street near the house. It was one of those big pocket knives that maybe a Boy Scout might carry. And I saw this glinting, rusted thing, I remember, in the gutter. And it just somehow connected in my mind, and I took this knife home, and I put it under my pillow. You know, it was like an eight-year-old. I'll keep this knife there, and I can use it to protect my mother, you know, And I remember a couple of times whenever I heard any loud noises, being startled, afraid that there was going to be some sort of violence in the house, I'd reach for this knife, but I was too scared to use it. I was a child, you know. It was pathetic.
I'm wondering how that left you feeling about raising a family yourself.
I know certainly in my 20s, up until my late 20s, that, and certainly now, my relationship with my father certainly colored my attitude toward men. It was like, don't bother me. You know, I don't want to be in a permanent relationship because men just get in the way. They cause problems, you know. And I don't feel that way now. I mean, there are other things one works through when you have a disastrous relationship with a parent. And when a daughter has a bad relationship with a father, the most important male figure in her life, you're always trying to heal that wound. And it's a constant process, as we say, of recovery, you know. But a psychic once said to me, Itabari, I see you standing at a temple door. You are encrusted with gold, and there are hundreds and hundreds of steps behind you. You're just draped, glittering with gold, and you're standing at the temple door, but you're carrying two beat-up bags, and you cannot enter the temple door until you release the baggage. And undoubtedly, the baggage was my father, or at least one of those bags. And I know that I have come to at least one of those bags, and that I am traveling much lighter because I have forgiven him. It was a slow, slow process. That same psychic said, light candles, light candles. I lit candles, and then one night I knocked them all off a table and said, the hell with the candles. You were a son of a bitch. You were a mean bastard. I have a right to hate you, and I'm never going to forgive you, even if I have to come back to this life 20 more times. And then gradually, at a much deeper level after that, I really began to forgive my father. I always understood intellectually why he was in such pain, but emotionally, the forgiveness was hard.
Well, at one point, does like your sense of enlightened sociology penetrate to the emotions and allow you to forgive your father or your mother?
Yeah, it happened. You know, I guess it's the maturation process. It's, you know, being an adult yourself, you know. But I also started just to remember my father's laughter, you know. And he was funny. He used to go around the house singing all the time. You know, he had a great tenor voice. His idol was John McCormick. And I'd find him in the kitchen sometimes singing, "For I've lately took a notion for to cross the briny ocean. And I'm off to Philadelphia." You know, that famous folk song, you know. And he loved all that stuff. And I'd hear him doing all that and doing these little Jackie Gleason and Away We Go motions. You know, he was a funny character. And so now when I think about him, as opposed to always these negative things that I thought about when I was in my teens and in my 20s, I hear him laugh now. And that's liberating for me and for him, too, I think.
We're recording this interview during Black History Month, and I wonder what you think of Black History Month. I know in broadcasting, it's often the opportunity where we're like, well, let's invite on some black people because it's Black History Month, and in February we have on black people. Do you know what I mean? It's on the one hand, I think, a kind of way of ghettoizing black history and black people. On the other hand, it's a time to kind of celebrate black history. Which do you feel more defines the month?
It's a ghettoization, undoubtedly, you know, of the culture. You know, I'm a reporter, and I'm often asked, or have in the past, you know, could you do something special for Black History Month? Or what happens is that lots of white reporters and other people do these great stories, and they say, well, why aren't we doing this all year long? These are great stories. And that's precisely the point. There is no White History Month, you know?
I want to thank you very much for talking with us and for discussing your new book with us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Ida Barrianjeri is a writer for the Los Angeles Times. Her new memoir, Every Goodbye Ain't Gone, is published by Random House. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have from South Africa today?
We'll be covering the return to Soweto Township today of Nelson Mandela, a report on his speech there, and response from the crowd. Also, I'll talk with a member of South Africa's Conservative Party who wants treason charges brought against the African National Congress because Mr. Mandela has been talking about armed struggle against the white-controlled government. The Conservatives are also calling for new elections to unseat the leadership of President F.W. de Klerk. And we'll be covering this story. Rioting in the Soviet Republic of Tajikistan continues. More than 37 people have now said to have been killed. The Tajiks are reported to be upset because of other ethnic groups moving into their country.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carlton Carlton, and I bring you exciting news indeed. Tonight, dentists Bess and May Mucho present Meet the Wunderkind. Meet the Man. An evening with Basil Starling, genius of the... A mega genius of the... A magna cum genius of the American popular song.
Thank you, Mr. Carlton. I am, as always, obediently yours. Tonight, I sit before the fresh air grand piano to offer a few of my original compositions.
Listen, Mr. Starling, what I'd like to hear is a great Valentine's Day song.
Indeed, Terry, what could be more important than Valentine's Day?
You know, Mr. Starling, Valentine's Day is important, but so is the problem of painless tooth extraction.
Really?
Yes, Basil, Terry's right. And what could be a more perfect Valentine's present for your loved one than Bess and May Mucho's Hydraulic Home Tooth Extractor?
What I'm presenting to you, Terry, is a new song especially designed to appeal to sophisticated fresh air listeners. It's a tender ballad I call Love is a Quiet Thing.
Love is a quiet thing! Love is a quiet thing!
Excuse me, what is the nature of love?
It's a quiet thing!
Well, what did you think, Terry?
Sounds too much like the Beach Boys.
Beach Boys? I've never heard of that particular Shakespearean troupe. But listen to this.
Mr. Sterling, I've got a tape I want you to hear. Apparently, it's your band, the Punsters, recorded at a club last Valentine's Day.
Oh, Terry, you don't want to hear that. It's a very poor quality recording.
No, I think our listeners would like to hear.
Oh, it's not even my band, Terry. Some roguish listener sent it in as a prank.
Well, then you wouldn't mind my playing it.
Well, I...
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carlton Carlton, and tonight I bring you exciting news indeed. Now, before we start the Elvis Presley sound-alike contest, I want to introduce a man who might best be described as an authentic genius of contemporary cabaret. A super genius of contemporary cabaret, Basil Starling.
Thank you so much, Mr. Carlton, members of our distinguished audience here in the fabulous Sinatra-Rama room. I am, of course, obediently yours. Now, before we start the Elvis contest, we'd like to sing a little boogie-woogie number we call the Valentine's Day Boogie. And the song goes something like this. Our hearts are beating fast. Forget about the past. Just make the feeling last. Doing the Valentine's Boogie. All together, boogity-boogity-shoo. Listen, gentlemen, I still don't think you're quite grasping the premise here. You see, I say the Valentine's Boogie, and you say, gentlemen, you still don't seem to appreciate the tour de theatre we're shooting for here. I'd have been handed a note. Get off the stage, you no-talent. Ladies and gentlemen, I understand your natural ebullience on a Saturday night. I myself felt it during the opening night of my 1954 one-man performance of No Sex, Please, We're Geniuses. It is dangerous to hurl the... Well, it was a very interesting recording, Terry. What did you think of my Valentine's Day boogie?
Are you finished with that soda?
Why, yes. Ow!
Hey, he'll survive. Basil Starling and Carlton Carlton come to us courtesy of Robert Kaplow and the Punsters. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, speechwriter Peggy Noonan on writing for Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Also, novelist Valerie Martin takes a fresh look at the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.